I am Paige Albiniak, editorial director at Promax, and this is the Daily Brief podcast. So today I have invited back with me the brilliant Linda Ong, chief culture officer at Civic Entertainment. And she is going to talk to me today about an essay that she posted on Medium, which I am reposting here on Brief. And it's about how to get comfortable with being uncomfortable. And as I was just telling Linda, I'm a pretty uncomfortable white woman right now. So we're going to get into a little bit, and hopefully our conversation will help open up other people's conversations. So hello, Linda. Welcome, always.
Hi, Paige. Thank you for having me, as always.
Yeah, as I just said, I saw your post when you tweeted it. As the aforementioned uncomfortable white woman myself right now, I felt like it was the right thing at the right time. It spoke to me. It was helpful. What inspired you to write it?
Being in the culture business, I've been having a lot of conversations really for the past 3 months at a very intense level, but really got accelerated in the last 2 weeks after the really brutal and tragic death of George Floyd, and then the protests, which became riots, and then Blackout Tuesday. It's just been an avalanche. And I think in talking to a lot of friends and family and other loved ones, what I saw was a lot of confusion. And I just felt I'm sort of in an interesting position being a person of color who has faced discrimination and racism in my past. And it's probably a big reason that I do all the work that I do. You know,
that's
which
a separate therapy conversation.
That's a whole therapy. Oh, I just monetized and weaponized my issues. But, you know, being in the culture business, culture and identity business comes from stuff I'm trying to work out in my own life and have been. But, you know, just seeing that people were struggling. And I always see the work that I do is trying to create empathy and understanding and helping people connect with other people, which, you know, on a commercial level is about business and selling shows or products, but on a, you know, on a human level is just about trying to help people hear each other and understand each other. So I just felt like there were a lot of, you know, there's a lot of confusion, but there's some paths to clarity. And I just wanted to put those down on paper.
Why do you think you are an Asian American. I am a white American, I guess. I don't think that's a phrase, but anyway, why are we so uncomfortable? What about this makes us so uncomfortable? Why is it so hard for us to have these conversations?
That's a really great question. I think it's because, especially people who have quote unquote privilege, meaning we have not suffered greatly economically or professionally or personally, that, you know, and if you're a liberal or progressive, you think of yourself, and I think of myself and many others as very open, inclusive. It used to be the terrible word tolerant, but already having very good instincts and being good people. And I think what has happened in this conversation is that, as I like to say, if you're successful right now, it is because you have been complicit in the system. That doesn't mean it's a bad thing, but you have benefited from the system, you have gamed the system, or you have been elevated through the system that has disadvantaged other people. And so understanding that, A, there's the issue of implicit or unconscious bias, which is getting elevated again, and that's really important. And that's also true in the Me Too conversation and conversations about women and all people of difference. But also, I think when it's an issue as really emotional and painful as race relations and the really ugly history of slavery in this country, and recognizing that good people can also participate in things that hurt other people, it's hard. It's hard for people to admit mistakes, number one. It's really hard when good people have to admit and understand and reconcile that maybe things they did or thought were not so good. And that being raised in a world where things were normalized that were racist, that's why everybody talks about systemic racism, which is different than systematic, which was another tweet that I sent out, but let's hold that for another, you can Google that. But systemic racism just means that what's normal had racist effect or sometimes intentions. And a lot of those go back to both stereotypes and preconceptions and the way people were treated from slavery. So it's painful for everybody. It's painful in the Black community. That's why when people riot, it's not because they want to be violent. It's because they want to be heard. And this is not the first time that the Black community has had this conversation with white America. We had Eric Garner. We've had the civil rights movement. We've had, you know, many, many times in this country's history where we've had to come to terms with racism. So this is not a new conversation, but it is, I think, on the heels of COVID and the quarantine and everyone feeling literally so exposed and vulnerable and having existential conversations, that it happened at a really interesting time where people just felt the humanity of the moment when they watched that video of George Floyd.
Can you talk about why you think, how you think the quarantine, stay at home, et cetera, contributed to this moment?
Yeah. Well, I think everyone in the world was affected by and still affected by the quarantine. And people of privilege, people of no privilege have had their lives upended in one way or another. And through that, two things, I think. One, incredible exposure to and gratefulness and appreciation for the people who keep the world running when the rest of us are at home, to the healthcare workers, to the essential workers, to the first responders who couldn't stay at home. You know, there was a lot of criticism with the stay at home movement because there are a lot of people who couldn't stay at home, and maybe workers who didn't, who would have rather stayed at home, but because, you know, they were on the front lines, needed to fulfill their duty or really needed the money, which both are very viable. So that was number one. And I think the other thing that's really interesting, it hasn't been talked a lot about, but we were all so focused on our screens, or we have been for the past 2 to 3 months, where everything we do is screen related, where it's work or school or watching streaming shows or whatever, that when we saw George Floyd on screen, it almost was too real and too present, because that's how we're processing everything in our lives right now. And so I think it just affected people really differently. I also think that particular video with that particular officer staring into the screen was just chilling. And people just kind of got outraged. And I think, again, just going back to the looting. So part of the looting was anarchists and people, extremists, both on the far right and the far left, just being chaos profiteers and opportunists and taking advantage of the moment. But the initial rioting that happened, like the burning of the police precinct, was just desperation of all these other methods had never really gotten people's attention. So sometimes that's what people do. They don't want to burn down their own neighborhoods because they're gleeful about it. They're doing it because they're just desperate.
Do you think also, because this might be obvious, but because we've been in quarantine, because this pandemic hits African-American communities and poor communities harder, or has hit them harder, because mm-hmm. I think it's something like 40% of the unemployed are, actually, let's not cite that stat because I'm not sure it's true, but a large percentage of the unemployed are African-American. So yeah, that community's been hit really hard anyway. And so that's already yep. illustrating this issue about privilege. And then the George Floyd yes. video comes out on top of Ahmaud Arbery, on top of Amy Cooper and yes. Christian Cooper in Central Park. And it's just a pile on, and it's just boiled yep. over.
Yeah. Well, it's still happening. I mean, these yeah, videos, absolutely. Here's the amazing thing. Somebody just said it, and it was kind of duh obvious, but like this stuff's been going on. It's only we believe it when there's video, you know. Yeah. But this stuff has been going on, and I think that the, you know, the outpouring of other videos, I don't know how they're getting surfaced, but I'm in a way it's both really disturbing and really kind of a relief that this stuff is getting out there. And so, yeah, I mean, you're 100% right. It's all related. I mean, that's the way culture works, right? Nothing really happens in a vacuum mm-hmm. other than just like weird one-off fads. But everything's related. Culture's an ecosystem. And so if George Floyd had happened in a time of non-COVID where we weren't all so kind of vulnerable already, it might have just been another one of those unfortunate events. but yeah. because people's mindsets were, people feel there's a lot of mental health, and yes, it's worse and more, the statistics are bad for marginalized communities, but you know, there's an epidemic, the pandemic of COVID and the epidemic of police brutality and the epidemic of mental health. You know, I also talk about this as a perfect storm.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, plus, by the way, plus the economic devastation of all the unemployed, you know, 20 million unemployed and, you know, all that. It's just, it's like a quadruple, quintupled perfect storm.
Yeah, no. I mean, the only thing I think is that you hope looking forward that all of this is for a purpose, you know, that it all takes us somewhere better in the end, but we will see.
Well, the good news is, you know, if you look back historically, which my team has been doing a lot of, because in these kinds of moments of seismic change, you know, you have to look at the macro, you can't look at the micro. And, you know, we've gone back and we've looked at the 1918 Spanish flu and World War I, and how after that period, well, actually, we've even gone back to the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, because the Black Death, the plague, it's really fascinating because it started in Italy and, you know, was decimated a huge swath of population worldwide. But what's really interesting is what came out of that period was the Renaissance, which also started in Italy, which is interesting to me because Italy was, you know, in Europe, one of the hardest hit and the earliest of the COVID pandemic.
Right.
But the fact that such an amazing flourishing of art and music and philosophy and science came out of that era, to me, is very heartening. And if you look after World War I and the Spanish flu, you have the jazz age, so music, you have flappers, so fashion, you have surrealism, so art, you know, you have all these movements that spring up in the wake of these things. And then even you go to World War II, and the end of World War II was the birth of postmodernism and the new look from Dior. And there is a human, seems to be a human desire to mark the change when we come out of it, so that there's a very visual and semiotic demarcation between past and present and future. So I'm, it's hard and it's ugly, but I'm hopeful. And I think Obama has been a really interesting voice because he's consistently optimistic and consistently framing this moment as an opportunity and half full. So I think we just have to remember that it might be painful now, but, you know, after the Depression, you know, the Wizard of Oz introduced color movies. So anything can happen.
I think also it's, you know, I've said this a lot to people, but it's sort of the people who are in power currently fighting to hold on to power. And, you know, I mean, most of who's in power in our country right now are older white men. And, but you mm-hmm. see, you know, TikTok, you see, I mean, it's Pride Month, so and you see a lot of young LGBTQ plus activists. You're just seeing a lot mm-hmm. of young voices coming up against that older establishment. And I do think it is painful, but that's what transition requires. So, you know, maybe that will galvanize them so much that they'll have enough momentum to keep pushing this forward once this administration passes through.
Yeah, well, that's got to be the message for everybody, is we got to make sure this administration ends, right?
Yeah.
And so that's for sure. And, you know, the thing about Black Lives Matter is I don't personally view it, or professionally really, as a political move. It's a human rights emergency. You're mm-hmm. either, there's no neutral. You can't be like this whole idea, I'm not a racist. No, you're either a racist or you're anti-racist. That's it. That's
explain that. Explain that, because I know there's this whole anti-racist thing and I have not dug into it as much as I should. So what, you know, when people say how to be an anti-racist, there's that book and it's definitely been out there and discussed. Yeah. What is the distinction?
Well, I think Ben and Jerry's did one of, I think, still the best posts or responses in the moment to
that's
George
strong,
Floyd's murder,
sure.
which is, yeah, well, they said, we're against white supremacy.
No, I mean, it was appropriate. It was just a very strong brand statement that you don't usually see.
But it was really bold because what they're saying is, and again, there's a whole science of people, social scientists and sociologists who study like how people respond to these kinds of moments. And I remember reading after 9/11, there was a really great article in the New Yorker about how terrorism has changed and evolved to the point where they, you know, terrorists were learning how to fly planes and fly them into buildings because the on the ground airport controls got so good. Right. And so when someone is trying to enforce an action, in that case, a very terrible action, and perpetrate terrorism, and you can't just bring a knife or a gun on a plane anymore, you have to keep, and the security tightens, you have to keep upping the ante in terms of your tactics. And I think in terms of activism, it's the same thing. It's like if a march doesn't quite get people's attention or a post doesn't quite get people's attention, you have to go more and more, you know, you have to be stronger and bolder with your message. And so the point is that for, again, like good people have said for decades, I'm not a racist. But what they haven't necessarily said is I'm against racism. Like that's a different stand. And it may be semantics, it may be half empty, half full. But I think what you're seeing is that being able to denounce something, not by defining what it isn't, but, you know, I always say with branding, I always say to my clients, you know, part of the value set that you create for your brand is not only what you stand for, but what you stand against. And one of the earliest and iconic brands that was a pioneer of this kind of thinking was way back in the day, I'm really dating myself, The Body Shop, which was, you know,
the Body Shop is still here. Yeah.
They're still around, but their brand, you know, nobody really talks about them anymore. But in the day, back in the day when they launched in the US, I believe they were a UK brand, you know, they were like advertising, we're against animal testing, which is basically what the entire beauty industry was based on at that time. And so you can define yourself by who you stand against. And I always used to fight clients because they'd say, oh, it's so negative. But now, sometimes the occasion calls for really defining yourself, defining your adversary. And so I think that the difference between not racist and anti-racist, yes, it's kind of semantic, but I think it's also a recognition that neutral or passive language doesn't really fly right now.
I think
everyone needs
to
be an advocate or an advocate in this moment.
I think that's the piece of it that makes this uncomfortable for people like me, because not because you're like, I'm for racism or I'm a racist or I'm not a racist, but because you're like, what are the things I'm doing in the course of living my little life where I'm taking advantage of things I don't know I'm taking advantage of, where maybe I am doing racist things and I don't even know. It's the little subtle things that are potentially insidious. It's not me saying microaggressions. Just even just being ignorant. You know, it's like, Ben and Jerry's comes out and says, we are against white supremacists. Well, yeah, of course, I am also against white supremacists. But what is it that we as people with privilege are doing that are oppressing other people that we don't even know about? I think that to me, and then also the call to be, you know, take action, be an activist. And sometimes that's not comfortable for people. So I think all of those things are hard, but it's also good, like raise that in the conversation and make people a little uncomfortable. People aren't going to do anything if they're comfortable. That's for sure.
Well, they're not going to change. Change is always uncomfortable. And I always felt like this, that's the strangest thing to me in the world, is that people are really resistant to change. And it is, you know, it's trite, but it's true. It's the only constant, is that things are always going to change. Every day we change, we're growing. You know, we're growing physically and emotionally.
Ideally.
And I think you can't not change. The world is changing. The weather changes every day. The environment is changing. So change is here. I think, you know, some of the political divide is that people think they can lock down the status quo or go back to, you know, things from the 1800s or whatever. I think part of the problem, my own personal view, this is not my professional view, but my personal view, is a lot of the problems in this country are that just because the North won the Civil War, it doesn't mean that the South accepted it. And, you know, we see that in the fight about the Confederate statues and the Confederate flags and, you know, people say that's our history. And it's like, well, yeah, but do you want to celebrate, you know, an ugly part of your history? So it's, that becomes, you know, that sort of identity politics and things like that. Those are trickier, but I think if we're going to live in communities together, we have to find the common ground and celebrate the common ground, not celebrate the things that divide us.
I think it's also about, my husband and I were just having this conversation because we were talking about the Confederate flag and how, and also like the statue in Richmond of General Lee that they mm-hmm. are taking down, mm-hmm. but how, you
yeah,
know,
now they want to rename the military bases and things like that.
Right, so. Right, exactly. But how those things, I mean, again, this is, again, I think an issue of being ignorant of what is privilege, or those things to some people are symbols of racism. To some people, they are not. They're symbols of our history or whatever, but you're still making a huge portion of the society extremely uncomfortable by holding those symbols up. And I don't think everyone gets that. And I don't even know that until we explicitly discussed it that I really got it. But if you're, you know, if you're in NASCAR and you've got the Confederate flag flying, what is that saying to people? Is that saying this is an inclusive place for you to come and feel comfortable and be a part of? No.
Right.
So, yeah.
I think the point about ignorance is exactly the point, which is this is a moment where education, you have never heard so many people use the word education in 1-2 week span than, you know, in the last 2 weeks. And I think education is, in this era where every piece of information is available to us at our fingertips, there is no excuse for ignorance now. And I think, and I hear this from people who are Black, from white, from every color, every creed, that, you know, there's stuff they're discovering that they didn't know. And some of it just even comes from conversations. I mean, I've had conversations with coworkers and colleagues that, you know, it was similar, again, not to say there's an extreme parallel, but I think it's analogous to all the conversations that happened when Me Too happened and all the conversations mm-hmm. men and women were having, and, you know, men didn't understand and women were, you know, coming out with all their harassment stories that many people had not told publicly because there wasn't cultural permission. And that's what's happening now, is a lot of people are, my colleagues and coworkers are saying, well, yeah, this happened to me. And it's like, oh my God, I had no idea. And some of them are overt, hostile, you know, racial harassment and discrimination. Some of them are microaggressions, but I think we just have to be incredibly humble at this moment. And mm-hmm. I say this both to both people and brands, that what this moment calls for, if you want to come forward and use your voice, is first to have a combination of incredible, well, first you need to educate yourself. Number one, before you speak up, whether it's in a meeting or on social media, you need to understand what
people
you
on
don't
social
know.
Media educate themselves. What?
Well, you know, more and more, actually, interestingly, I was on a webinar with a woman from Instagram, and she was saying Instagram's primarily, as we know, a visual platform, but they're finding more and more people are using it for text. And they're not necessarily encouraging that, but what I deduce from that is that visual is not enough, and that there's this is a complicated conversation, and it requires words and requires a lot of people talking to each other. But I think that, so I think first it's like really educating yourself on what it is that you want to say, and then, or what is it that you don't know? What aspects of this would you like to learn more about? And then, you know, really talking and sharing and opening up yourself with a tremendous amount of humility that you don't know. And you see this happening I mean, Adidas had to apologize to their staff, because even though they were one of the first to retweet Nike's, and Nike was the first, of course, Nike had a post over the weekend of the protest. Yeah, don't do it. Yeah. And Adidas and Reebok retweeted it, which was both an act of humility because it was a competitor, as well as generosity. And we're seeing more of that. There's a two tea companies in the UK that had a similar kind of stance. So you see, wait, why
did Adidas have to apologize?
Because they posted a, you know, they were posting, we support Black creators and athletes, whatever, but then their employees said, but your workplace is not reflecting those ideals. And they had grievances. There's an article about it. You can Google it. But they had grievances and needed, again, a reckoning and accounting. And so one of the things I've been advising brands and talent right now is, I keep saying the first thing. There's so many first things. So you have to educate yourself. But also, you have to look at yourself and do an audit and really understand, who am I as a person? Where did I grow up? What was my upbringing? What was the conversation about race in my family? Any kind of difference, but in this conversation about Black and white relations, and understand, you know, what the environment was that you were raised in, and then go look at, you know, your friends and social circle. What kind of influences are you having there? The kinds of things that you text and tweet and, you know, share links with each other, your intimate circle, how diverse is that, and how are you affected by those opinions? And then you can look at your team, you know, your staff, your coworkers, your bosses, and look at how diverse that is. And then you can look at your partners. Whose businesses are you helping to build? Who's helping to build your business? Who are your vendors and suppliers? And what do they look like? And then lastly, you know, who's your audience? What do they look like? What do you want them to look like? We had a great conversation on this webinar with the Instagram woman, and then also Emmanuel Acho, who is this NFL star who's totally blowing up this week because he posted two videos on YouTube called Uncomfortable Conversations with a Black Man that I highly recommend. Hopefully you can link to that. It's really good because it's aimed at Dear White People, which is kind of the purpose of my op-ed, was a Dear White People kind of op-ed, which is here's what you need to know in these conversations. So I think if you do an internal audit and you can identify what some of the weaknesses are or what are the holes, and then come up with, you know, an action plan, whether formal or informal, to educate yourself. And that could, again, that could be people, that could be watching. I watched Ava DuVernay's 13th over the weekend. You know, you could watch, there's tons of books, there's tons of movies, TV, you know, and just understand different perspectives on this conversation, tons of articles, tons of social media. And the other thing, which I put in my op-ed, is to understand that, you know, like, all white people aren't the same, all Black people aren't the same. They're not all monolithic. And I've had people say, well, you know, I talk to my Black colleagues and they all have different opinions about this. And it's like, yeah, they're human, you know, and that I always, as you know, we've had this conversation, I like to make the distinction between multiculturalism and omniculturalism. And multiculturalism really does create monolithic views of difference. And that's where you end up with token people, right? And omniculturalism understands that everybody's very, very diverse and intersectional. And a Black person may have more in common with someone like me than someone who looks like them just because of their upbringing. I mean, I didn't grow up in a particularly Asian environment. I grew up in Texas, so I don't have that much in common with other Asians, other than the way I look. I mean, there's a little bit, but it's not, and I just have such a crazy, my family has such a crazy history. So, you know, the outward markers, just because someone's Black doesn't mean that they think, you know, one way. And so, you know, there's a lot of uncomfortable conversations happening in the Black community right now, because not everybody likes, you know, even when Blackout Tuesday had happened, not everybody was happy about the Black Square and the hashtag. That was usually controversial. Yeah. The intentions were good. But again, like, everybody's taking this very personally, which is why it's uncomfortable, it's emotional, it's painful. But you have to recognize and you have to be open to learning what you don't know and figuring out or discovering or being told what you don't know. And so we're all ignorant in this moment. But I would rather say we all need to just be open to learning.
Yeah, I agree with that. Myself included.
Nobody has the answers here.
No, we're already over time. I could talk to you about this for several more hours. We didn't even really scratch the surface, truthfully. But the one thing I wanted to ask you about before we go is you were going to explain, because I really don't totally understand this myself, when there's Black Lives Matter and then people come back and say, but all lives matter and that is problematic.
Yeah.
Explain why that is.
Well, Black Lives Matter is about focusing a light on systemic injustice and inequality towards the Black community that's 400 years old, right? Mm-hmm. Many, many other communities of difference, whether it's Pride Month this month, so whether it's the LGBTQ plus community or the Asian community or the Latinx community or the trans community or the people of different abilities, difference is something we're all trying to normalize and get everybody to be stopping afraid of people that are different. But what happens when we say all my lives matter, which is true, and it's not that anybody, again, from an omnicultural perspective, that's exactly right. But we have to be able to shine a light sometimes on, okay, let's pay attention to this problem in society right now. Just like there was a lot of attention on LGBTQ plus folks and the trans community and gay marriage, and there's still a lot of work to be done. It's not to say that that's done and, you know, check the box and move on, but this is a moment that we need to capitalize on because so many eyes are on it because of George Floyd. George Floyd is not the problem, or this is not an issue that is centered around George Floyd. I look at George Floyd as the Rosa Parks of our era. He will be the person that we remember as the symbol of getting people's attention, just like Rosa Parks on the bus got people's attention. And what I would say to people is, yes, all lives matter, but right now we need to step up and make sure that people that essentially our Black friends and family and colleagues and loved ones and people we don't even know are afforded the kinds of treatment, and hopefully we can try to reconcile some of the privileges they haven't been party to. And it's not going to happen overnight. This is a long, long, you know, it's probably another 400 years, but we have to all own the problem. And so when we say all lives matter, it almost allows people to pass on owning the problem.
Yeah. I think it's like, again, gives cover to privilege.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I like to say to people, think about this moment in time as being as seismic as some of the events that I mentioned. And what do you want to remember your role in this moment as being? Do you want to, you know, be able to tell your kids and grandkids who are going to read about this moment? They're going to read about George Floyd, and they're going to say, well, what did you do? What was that like for you? Do you want to say, like, I posted a hashtag? Or do you want to say, I really tried to make change in myself and my world? And that's really, I don't think it's a hard thing. I think it's just an openness to wanting to be part of it.
Okay. That's a good spot to, well, it's a good spot to end this beginning conversation
for now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
That's the other thing. This is not a one-off conversation. You know, this is going to be a lot. We will be revisiting this for a very long time, but I think it's good for all people who are different will benefit from this kind of conversation. So while the spotlight is on Black Lives, and I know that some people are upset, but I think that we can't change everything at once. So this is an area of focus for right now. And let's try to do as much as we can before the spotlight shifts to something else.
Thank you so much, Linda. I hope everyone
As always.
Got a little inspiration out of that and a little challenge
so.
To open your minds a little bit.
Yeah, I'll leave you one more thing. I also like to say, if there was no social media that you could post or hashtag or whatever now, how would you behave? What would you do if you haven't already? I mean, a lot of my friends have been going to protests and doing things and making donations, but how would you behave if you couldn't tell anybody about it? Would you just stay home and not do anything, or would you try to make change happen? So that's something to think about.
Thank you so much. We will talk again
soon. Thank you, Paige. Okay.
All right.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
That's it for this episode of the Daily Brief podcast. If you don't already, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have comments, questions, or ideas for conversations, please feel free to reach out to us at dailybrief@promax.org. And as always, thanks for listening.